it's the converse is something. I mean, once you see what the three manifold Hungarian looks like, the converse is something you think of immediately. It's not really the making the relative three manifold. So the converse is a relative three manifold Hungarian for three manifolds with boundary, and but it's something you think of immediately. This takes separate work from just making the three-manifold invariant. See, when you make the three-manifold invariant, you just have to show that if you have two different descriptions of the three-manifold, that the words are equal. Well, they're equal by axioms. So this is really doing more. This is saying that the three-manifold doesn't change. In fact, the three-manifold can change, but the three-manifold doesn't change very much. And there is a canonical model, no matter how you apply the axioms to the words.
So, I mean, don't you just have a construction from a diagram, from a Hopfisch diagram, to manifolds?
Right, but the manifold isn't unique, and you actually have to do some topology to find a canonical representative.
Oh, so it's not a canonical construction from diagrams.
It's
to
not
manifolds.
At first. Eventually, yes, but it's not at first a canonical construction. The obvious construction gives you many different three manifolds.
Uh-huh.
But there's a unique simplest one.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's a simplest candidate.
Okay. So you have to tell us about that.
I will. In fact, I can even build up to it more.
Okay. Should wait, then I should take a picture. What? Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, you can erase.
Can you leave my stuff here and be back after?
What? You can leave your stuff.
I'm just leaving.
Sure. We'll steal it. Ah, it's valuable stuff. Good.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
So, related. Definition. This is another question in much the same spirit. Instead of the Hopf algebra, the Hopf algebra tensors, you have just a vector space with an R matrix, and instead of the Hopf algebra axioms, you have the Yang-Baxter equation. Okay. And so then, motivated by the word problem, with the dot where word means a diagram, Kaufmann invented virtual tangles and virtual links. And that's where that came from. Okay. And he was hoping to get something that looked very different from three-manifold topology, or at least different enough that it could be new. But I have a theorem here, which was inspired by my experience in the Hopf algebra case, and the answer is that it's not all that different. There's a proposition. I wrote it down, but it was known before, which is that there's a similar to the Hopf case, which is that minimal choice. It's obvious that anyone can think of turning a virtual link into a link in a surface cross an interval, but this is not a unique topological model. The theorem that takes the work is that of all of these models, there's one that's minimal and that one is unique.
Minimal in
what
sense, genus-wise?
Two conditions, minimal genus and most components, most connected components. The surface doesn't have to, I didn't say the surface is connected. If it's a link, well, if it's a knot, then the surface is connected. But if it's a link, then you could have some of the link over here in one surface and more of the link in another surface. So you can put it all together. Minimal means largest Euler characteristic for the surface.
It suffices to consider just connected things?
If it's a knot.
Right, okay.
Because you have, in order for the surface to be, to justify a component of the surface, that you have to have one of the knots in it. But if it's a link, no, then it doesn't. Then you could separate into separate knots and or sublinks in different surfaces. Okay. Right. Now I should also give
the history of that. You may remember was that Dylan and I were having occasional on my sabbatical in Berkeley in 1999-2000. Dylan and I were occasionally driving to Davis to talk to you and occasionally to Michael Hovanov. And at some point, I think I mentioned to you this link in surface model for virtual links. And like a week later, you came back with this theorem.
Right. Well, the reason I could do it quickly is that it doesn't require new ideas. It's the same as the Hopf case.
Okay.
Is this going to be posted? Is the whole video going to be posted to the web?
In a largely invisible place. You're worried?
No, not yet.
Everything can be decided later. There is no. I can assure you, though, that nobody ever looks at these things.
I'm not going to be embarrassed, but I don't want to say something that would offend people.
Yeah, but nobody ever looks. It doesn't matter.
I'll wait till the recorder's off.
Okay. Do you have something to say?
I'll wait. Okay. We'll discuss it later.
Okay.
It's not something I have to say.
Okay.
So anyway, they're actually both.
You shouldn't be conscious of that, of the recorder. It's just okay. I mean, you should see the things that I've recorded myself.
Both results are. Jacob Schaefer, JSJ composition. That's where it really comes from. I did the Hopf case as a graduate student, and the reason that I could go through that case relatively quickly is that actually all of the ideas were already in the air because Jake O'Shalin and Johansson had already done something more difficult. And the culture of three-manifold topology had already incorporated this result. It takes a little bit of thought to really convince yourself that these results are, that this uniqueness result is, both of the uniqueness results are really subordinate to Jake O'Shalin and Johansson, but that's true.
Okay.
So this is not this is a needed result in topology, but it's not an earth-shaking one.
No. Okay. Let's take another picture, and maybe we should actually start constructing these things, these invariants.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a diagrammatic proof of this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you? Because I don't remember seeing it. Well, but it's a quote. It's quoting Radford and Larson. But then there is a closed proof.
Well, I guess we're assuming the existence of non-zero right.
If I remember it, the involutory paper, the proof is not diagrammatic.
I think there's a diagrammatic. I think there's just a direct diagrammatic proof that it's new.
Okay. I don't know it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, if it's a Russian seminar, I don't know.
I think the second paper implies it. Actually, is what happens.
Sorry, the second paper?
It implies this result. Uh-huh. Including the finding that it's a diagrammatic.
Okay.
The second paper.
But then the proof should be three lines. It can't be more, right?
Yeah, but which
no
three
room.
Lines? In the second paper, I was much more careful about what was true diagrammatically and what only has a non-diagrammatical proof. And the general picture that was emerging in the second paper is that everything that you care about seemed to have a diagrammatical argument.
Yeah, but that's sort of significant, and I guess I missed that. We missed that when we read the first paper, because we read it first.
Well, I was partially missing it in the first paper. In the second paper, I was more careful.
Uh-huh. And you cannot reproduce or show us where the proof is in the second paper,
well,
is it?
Sure, it comes from...
I mean, how long is it? It's like...
Look,
again, it
you
can,
see, it comes from this. So
PR was this, right?
So this is, so in the involutory case, this is then equal to, sorry, you don't use that yet, so. If not. No, actually, you're right. There is a little bit of a mistake here. You do get that if you attach epsilon to both sides of this, then you do get this trace, because this part all disappears. Okay, but the only thing that's missing is that you didn't show that it's non-zero. Okay, so there's an extra thing. This is if a closed loop is invertible. So you need a slight extension of the set of axioms. You need something that you a non-manufacturable scalar element that is the reciprocal of the trace of the identity. And so with that slight alteration, you get that this is invertible.
Sorry, I don't see where you get the closed loop. So say it again. You put epsilon to the right there.
Right.
Then you get just T.
But you might have gotten the zero tensor. You have to check that you have not something non-zero. And the way that you check that it's non-zero is to plug.
Zero is an integral.
Yeah, but I wanted a non-zero integral.
But that's a separate theorem.
Yeah, that's right.
Zero
is implicit. What I said is an integral, I meant a non-zero integral, one that is actually useful.
Okay.
And for that, you need a slight refinement. You need to throw in a reciprocal of dimension of h into the calculus.
That
reciprocal is not an element that you can manufacture.
Yes.
Okay.
And the way you would show that sort of this m is this is non-zero is by putting a unit in,
right.
And then you'd get the circle. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So in fact, that's an issue in finite characteristic. For instance, suppose you have a group algebra whose cardinality is divisible by the characteristic of the field. Then in fact, this vanishes.
Yeah.
And there's another integral somewhere else.
Yeah,
that's got to do with the Venus map or something. I mean, is that related to it? Like in Berkowitz's group and you're in.
Yeah. So I don't remember exactly where I'm using this, but I need a little bit more than a finite dimensional Hopf algebra. For the involutory paper, I want one where there is a reciprocal element to the dimension.
Okay.
Right. Right. Right, and you will need that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. In a few interesting cases, even though it's involutory, this is actually a simplification of this tensor, and it can be an oversimplification. You get from here to here in the involutory case by plugging in epsilon here, but you might have missed, and epsilon could be in the kernel of this operator.
Mm-hmm.
Epsilon will only be in the kernel of this operator if this vanishes, if the dimension of the Hopf algebra vanishes. But that is, in fact, somewhat a serious issue. But I want to just keep that rule.
Okay. Wait. Picture, and then you can
erase.
Erase.
I guess you're also using that it's invertible when expressing everything in terms of threshold.
Yeah, that's right. But what I didn't fully realize.
Right. Can you move back a tiny bit? Good. Move on. Sorry.
What I didn't fully realize when I wrote the first paper was that there's a more careful calculation where you use these elements instead, where you actually never need to assume that. In the first paper I knew I needed this condition, but I didn't realize that there was a workaround that my use of this condition was relatively superficial, there were just little bit, there existed a little bit different expressions, so that you never needed this to be invertible to get what you want. Mm-hmm. Either of these conditions are fail, and actually, I think it was non-invoidatory in the second condition. No, sorry. If either of these conditions fail, then these are not important vectors because they're likely to vanish or have something else wrong with them. And so you get.
So, three manifolds with boundary wise, what do these correspond to?
Something not very satisfying because you need decorated boundary to. So one index isn't a specific. It is only in general a piece of a boundary component. Also, the relative version of this invariant, even the absolute version of this invariant, has what in the paper I call horizontal boundary. And the relative version where you have free indices corresponds to a case where you have both horizontal and vertical boundary. So these correspond to something small and trivial, like a single handle or something like that.
Yeah, but that's... you're dismissing it, but it's you're saying to construct every three manifold, we need three manifolds with boundary with certain specific kind of horizontal, vertical, colored boundary and certain gluing laws or whatever.
Right.
And these are the basic.
I'm dodging the answer for the following reason.
Okay.
It's
better because at least you're saying is that you're dodging the answer.
Yeah, but for a reason.
Okay.
Where Rohit in discussions with me left his relative result, there were certain conventions for what exactly the relative part of the three manifold looks like. It's morally, it's a problem with making a convention with male and female connectors. There is a connector, and you can put it on one side or the other side.
Okay.
So precisely what three manifold you get is a little bit negotiable.
Okay.
At the same time, for this tensor, the three manifold that you get is so small that the conventions for the connectors change the answer so much that the answer is boring.
Okay. Well, I mean, I hear you, yet...
It could correspond to the empty set, or it could correspond to just a connector. It corresponds to some very small thing. I don't remember exactly what you would call it, but the answer is not interesting because it's negotiable because of the convention of what exactly the connectors are supposed to look like. your question is generally more interesting for the, in the scalar case. I can give you a scalar question to make your question into a question with an interesting answer.
You mean C into T or something? Or?
Well, I'll give you the simpler. A scalar case you might be curious about. Trace of the antipode.
What manifold is it?
Right. The model is RP3.
Is a C into T, is that like a sphere? Is that
probably, but yeah, it probably is a sphere.
Like, what about the closed loop as well? Is that?
That's also a sphere because since I'm giving this reciprocal, these actually float around and don't change the manifold. But a three sphere is also this. A three sphere is actually not the minimal model for itself. The minimal model is the empty three manifold. So C into T become. The minimal model for C into T is actually the empty three manifold. You're supposed to throw away three sphere components.
So you're renormalizing.
Yeah, that's right. But you wouldn't throw away an RP3 component.
So I agree. I mean, so I can understand that C and T would be somehow the content will be hidden by too much choice, by too much freedom in choosing the normalizations. But still, it would be nice to make to choose a convention. And write the whole dictionary for that convention.
I was also dodging the question because I didn't know quite what technical answer to give you, but it's going to be something like that. T by itself is a single two handle, and T, one of them is a single two handle, and the other is a single one handle. It's going to be something like that.
Okay. No, but that's wonderful. That's beautiful.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Because of the connector, because of convention with connectors, you need a little bit more to get an interesting answer.
I'll tell you very briefly one place where we're coming from. I'm interested for several reasons, but one reason is that whenever you have an algebraic structure, it has a theory of finite type invariants. Now, this is a statement I need to justify. I don't know if you... Okay. Now, there are certain algebraic structures that are very closed to Hopf algebra, very close to Hopf algebras, whose associated finite type theories appear in a hidden form in various papers by Ettinghoff, Kashdan, Enriquez, etc. Okay? And it would be lovely to say that these papers are not just about finite type structures arising from some kind of arbitrary Hopf algebra calculuses, but that they are theorems about finite type structures arising from topology. So,
yeah, probably. Yeah, I thought about that for a while, but I never. Yeah, I sort of suspected the same thing, but I never worked things out carefully. So that I never had a result.
Okay. Anyway, so that's one reason why.
I think
why
you're probably correct.
That's one reason why I want to kind of be. Eventually want to understand these things precisely.
Yeah, I think they didn't simplify it. I think Ettinghoff and Kajdan didn't simplify what they were doing as much as they as much as they should have in because of this issue.
Okay.
And there should be connections to Kinsevich. But I never quite put I never got a result. I just sort of left it at that question.
Okay.
So we get cyclically symmetric tensors and wheels, but not the same wheels as in finite type theory, different wheels.
Yeah, yeah.
And then by associativity, this is equal to taking a product and taking the trace. You can think about how you would use associativity to get to here and here. Did you want to take a picture of that already?
It's up to you. If you're going to use the erasers, then yes.
Maybe I will.
Okay.
So now the invariant can be defined very quickly. So given
picture somewhere, and I'm trying to find it, but okay.
Third page of the, early on in the first paper. There you go.
Second paper.
Second. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Oh, it's virtually the same picture.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So this specific picture is actually a dimension-independent point. If you have a sufficiently favorable cellular tiling of any N-manifold, then you can thicken the cells and the handles. And that's an important construction for completely other reasons.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then, and there's going to be almost the same picture, and replace with to some power n, and then we have this, okay. where n is in z mod 2.
Well, but I thought we were still involutory, or we're not.
Yes, we are involutory.
Oh.
But s isn't the identity. You put in a power s to the n, where n is an element of z mod 2.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
This is motivated by the fact is that, so I got this construction by combining two considerations. One is that it directly gives you a well-known invariant if the Hopf algebra is a group algebra. Okay. And the other consideration is that I wanted it to be self-dual. I wanted Hopf algebra duality to match Poincaré duality. I mean, not homological Poincaré duality, but combinatorial duality of Hamiltonian compositions. Combinatorial duality. So this clearly does match combinatorial duality. Okay? And then the other thing that it does is if this is a group, if you have a group algebra, then it simplifies to something that you already know. Okay. And then after that, you say, wouldn't it be nice if this was an invariant? And then you just check the topological moves, and it works.
So, a few things. First of all, what is n? I know where it lives now, but now you still have to say what it is.
Okay.
How do I decide its value?
Okay. So,
can you write higher, or is it not?
So
there is a stool somewhere, by the way, which I use all the time.
I'm fine.
Okay.
Okay. So M, etc. is not dihedrally symmetric. So we orient.
Something?
No, traced.
Traced, sorry. Yeah.
Right. So I didn't put it, but this is a thought.
Yes, so just by convention, if you have an M with all ins, then it's traced.
So if you apply epsilon, then the whole thing degenerates into many copies of epsilon. If you apply the trace, then you get the correct. Right-hand rule converts a co-orientation of the one handle to an orientation of the one handle, and then you can directly see whether the orientation of the one handle and the two handle agree or disagree.
I'm happy, but I mean, are you happy? Are you?
The other part I didn't discuss is why this gives you something familiar if you have a group algebra, which was part of how I thought of it, as you say, many years ago.
Yes. Back when the dinosaurs were roaming the plains of Northern California.
I thought of this and I was so excited I fell off of my dinosaur.
Yes. Okay. It's on video, you know. This will be remembered forever.
Uh,
Okay, you can remove it then. At least on my labeling, the current picture, the current blackboard is titled "The Key Picture with Capitalized Key," because I think this. I mean, this little corner here really is everything. So.
For the involutory case.
Yes, for the involutory case.
If you want the invariant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Algebra is Hopf algebra? No.
Do we?
No.
Okay. Well, in any case, I'm not going to give one.
You just gave one. Okay.
Okay, then I am just giving one.
Okay.
Okay.
And, you just said the whole thing.
This is really, both of these two rules are now really everything.
Yes.
Okay. So, if you, so in the group basis, basis, what's going on here, you're coloring every rectangle of this one handle by the same group element.
Yeah.
And then the taking the trace of this product will give you zero unless the product of the group elements is the identity in the group, because the trace of any group element other than the identity is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get a non-zero answer for a term in the expansion, precisely when you have colored the edges by elements of the group in such a way that the product around every two cell is the identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the same answer for each such solution, which is some power of the number, which is the size of the group to the power of the number of two cells. Because the trace of the identity is the size of the group, it's not one.
So this idea come from computing simply from cohomology?
Right. It's the same Hom pi 1 M G, and it's the first cohomology of M with coefficients in G. That's a way to look at what you're doing. Normally, when you define cohomology, the group of coefficients has to be abelian. But first cohomology is an exception, where if you sort of cram it in, you can sort of cram in a non-abelian group instead. And then what is a cochain? It is a function on the edges taking values in the group. then what is the co-cycle condition? It's precisely that the product of the elements for every two dimension, for every two cell is the identity. So one ingredient was for the definition was duality. I thought it would be nice to get a self-dual invariant. And the other definition was that I saw the definition of this, and I noticed that what I was writing down matched that.
Does it matter that you're taking polygonalization rather than triangulation?
No. No. It doesn't really help. It can be a triangulation if you like, but it doesn't really help you.
And then all that changes is just the number of the arrows coming out of the delta and the number of the arrows going into the end or something like
well,
that.
Well, right. You see, it only helps you on one. It only, if you have a triangulation, then it means that the ends always just have three arrows. But the deltas don't. And also the combinatorial dual of a triangulation is some other polyhedral tiling, which is what's called a simple polyhedral tiling. The dual of a simplicial polytope is a simple polytope. The dual of a triangulation is a simple polyhedral tiling. So you're only making things simple on one side. And there's no point in restricting to that.
I guess in the opposite direction, it would be reconstructing the manifold from maybe some polygonal thing, not necessarily triangulation. When going from a diagram.
Yeah, you wouldn't particularly get.
So maybe we should talk about the opposite side then. Or is there more you want to say here?
No, this is roughly it. No, I can say a little bit more. It's not. So for general age, it's not known if values over age, you can plug in a group algebra and you get invariants but not new ones. That was in fact from the beginning. So there are some other examples of Hopf algebras known, but they're that are involutory, but they're sort of close to group algebras. And it's not known that whether you can get anything very different from this. So that's too bad. So this is a reason to try to make this motivates.
Is there a classification of involutory Hopf algebras? There isn't.
No.
You might not be up to date because it's sort of long ago, but have you talked to like the Hopf algebraists and
okay, no, I'm not up to date, but I would fall off my dinosaur again.
No, they're extinct now.
Still birds.
But anyway. They're birds, okay.
Sir, I have another question. Is it fair to keep interrupting?
Of course.
It's a Russian seminar.
Okay.
Which, to explain, is just a description of the seminar and not necessarily actual Russians.
Okay.
So at the end of the involutory paper, you mentioned this digraph invariant coming from a Dricot cycle in a finite group.
Yeah, I couldn't get that one.
So and then you pose the question of whether there's a common generalization of this and that one. So
right.
Do you know that has been solved, or has anyone worked on it more?
Well, I'm not any sure longer whether that's a good question. Probably in some sense the answer is yes, there is a common generalization.
But so why is it not a good question? Sorry. You said you are not sure it's a good question.
Because in a way it may already have been known. There's a generalized Terea-Vero invariant for every modulo intensory category. And you get a modular, there is a modular tensor category for this, and there's a modular tensor category. Yeah, there's a Terea-Vero definition of this. Yeah, I won't say modular tensor category. This is a special case of the Terea-Vero invariant. I didn't say how, but it is. Then.
So strictly special?
Right. Okay. Of the. Not. The original Terea-Vero invariant was only for one 6J symbol, but take a generalized 6J symbol first coming from some other category rather than just the SL2 case. Then there is a generalized Terea-Vero invariant. It was described by Barrett and Westbury. They have a pair of papers on the matter. One of them is called spherical categories. And so then this is one special case of Terea-Vero, and then Dyckerf-Witten is another special case of Terea-Vero. And I should have already understood that when I wrote that sentence. So in a way, there already is an answer, just the Terea-Vero invariant is a mutual generalization. And it's also sort of the mutual generalization I was looking for. The problem is that it's not defined my way. What I was really after was an invariant defined my way. But that, I don't know if it's a good question, because it's one thing to demand a theorem from other people. It's another, that's very often a good question. It's another to demand a theorem in your style. Demanding something in your own style can be a bad math question.
Do you think the Terea-Vero version is more complicated than it should be as well?
Well, that's what I thought when I wrote that, but now I'm not sure. Yeah, back then I would have complained that the Terea-Vero invariant is too complicated or more complicated than it should be. But now I'm not sure that I have anything to complain about. And if I don't, then my question disappears.
Take another picture. So, as for plans, I don't know, maybe we should go on until Karine is back, and then we should be in a few minutes, and then all together go to lunch. Is this in?
So I'm talking with Emily Peters at 12:30.
Well,
so unfortunately,
so you're
I won't
skipping
be able to
lunch.
Make it.
Okay, unless Greg, you're the one most victimized. So I mean, you might want time off, or I mean, you may have other plans.
So when did we start?
At 10.
It's
been 2 hours or so. But I'm happy
you,
to go on
I,
for another
I would put
six.
It this way.
It's just
If you force me to talk, I still will. I'll survive, but I think I will perform better if we take a break and have maybe have some food.
So you know what? Why don't we take the break now? Start the break now, but wait for Karine for food. How long are you talking to Emily for?
We may also be able to be rescheduled. I might be also able to push it back a little bit.
Or maybe,
so.
I mean, do you want to come back, I guess? That's
oh, absolutely.
So should we set to re-meet at 1:30, 1?
Oh, yeah. 1:30 would be probably better.
1:30.
That gives me an hour to talk to.
And that gives Greg more time to a bigger break. Let me turn off the video.